Shrink Wrap Radio number 626, Psychedelics and Exceptional Human Experience, with Dr. David Luke.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. David Luke, who's a senior lecturer for psychology in the Department of Psychology, Social Work, and Counseling at the University of Greenwich in the UK. We'll be speaking about the latest of his many books, Other Worlds, Psychedelics and Exceptional Human Experience. For more information about David Luke, PhD, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. David Luke, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hello, Dave. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here all the way from London. Are you in London?
Close to London. I work in London, but I live just outside in the countryside.
Ah, sounds nice. Well, I've really been looking forward to talking with you about your 2017 book, Psychedelics and Exceptional Human Experience. And as my listeners will know, I've become kind of reinterested in psychedelics as a result of the current psychedelic renaissance. And I think there is a global renaissance going on. Now, I don't know if you're old enough to have that perspective, that there's something happening all over again. What's your sense? It seems like there's an explosion of interest in psychedelics. Are you experiencing that?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I wasn't privileged to grow up in the 60s, but I read a lot of the literature and I'm very aware of what happened in the 60s. And I mean, I started out my career wanting to study psychedelics and, you know, it just wasn't possible. You know, when I was doing my undergraduate in the late 90s, and then my PhD, the turn of the millennium, there just wasn't anywhere you could study about psychedelics, you know.
And, nor was there when I was in graduate school somewhat earlier.
but now it really has mushroomed, you know. I think we're seeing an exponential increase in the amount of research that's happening. And, you know, I think that's it really started taking off in about the last 10 or 15 years or so. And it's really very noticeable in the last 5 years. Yeah. Very
much. Yeah. And I was thinking about that as I was waiting for you to come online and wondering, well, why was that? Because it's not just research interest, and it's wonderful that there is the research interest happening, but there's a growing popular interest, I would say. And I'm thinking, well, I mentioned to you before, just before we started talking here, that I've been influenced somewhat by Paul Austin, a very young guy, amazingly young, who's being amazingly influential. And so he's spoken about what he called the first wave, the second wave, and the third wave of psychedelics. The first wave being those earlier peoples, maybe pre-literate peoples. I won't use the word primitive, but they were living closer to nature, closer to the land, and so on, pre-scientific. And so that's the first wave. The second wave, of which I'm solidly a member, would have been the folks in and around the 60s, a bit earlier and a bit later. And then it kind of died down after the whole Timothy Leary thing. And now we're in a third wave. And so I was asking, well, what's different now that there seems to be such a renaissance? And I realize it's the internet. In the 60s, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have social media. But now people are communicating with each other across the globe. And things that would have been isolated to Peru or to Africa or the Netherlands, it would have stayed there pretty much. But now there's just a sort of an instantaneous explosion. We'll see what difference that makes in the long run. That's why I like talking to people like you, so I can keep my thumb on the pulse of what's going on. So how did you first become interested in psychedelics? I have to believe you didn't just out of nowhere say, I would like to study, do research on psychedelics.
I have to admit, I kind of dabbled with my brain like a bit of a neurochemistry kit when I was a teenager. And
teenager. Okay. We don't advise that. But
a late teenager, you know, an adult teenager. Okay. Not adult. And that inspired me to go away and study psychology with the sole purpose of understanding the psychedelic experience. So I did my first degree in psychology and I was woefully disappointed about how little I actually learned about the psychedelic experience during my degree. I even did a course on psychopharmacology, and we were basically given a 1 hour video in a seminar to watch on psychedelic research, you know, and that was it in a whole 3 year degree.
Sure.
And so I was compelled to then continue with my studies and do a PhD just so I could go into this area and really begin to answer or try and answer the questions that I had formed, you know, all those years ago. But even then, it wasn't possible to do a PhD even on a psychedelic topic because there was no one to supervise it. So
did anybody try to discourage you along the way from pursuing this line of research?
So one of my first supervisors at my undergraduate, they asked me back to teach at the university after my undergraduate degree, which was quite unprecedented. And I told her I was, after a year of working, I said, I'm going off to Mexico and South America to study shamanism, psychedelic shamanism. And she says, don't do that. You'll go mad and you won't come back, you know. but I went mad and came back, you know.
Yeah,
came back.
There you go.
That was the mad bit, you know. I came back and did a psychology doctorate, so. I didn't go.
Going back to your earliest experiences with psychedelics, I'm wondering, what was the impact on you? Can you describe, you know, what we could all go into our wonderful, magical mystery ride stories at some length, but how did it impact your young brain at that point?
I think it was quite extraordinary and, you know, quite a lot to compute. But I think it just gave me a sense of there being states of consciousness other than the waking state of consciousness, and that it was seemingly far more to explore and understand than our everyday waking consciousness, which we, you know, somewhat take for granted. And it also made me question everything, you know, about society and culture. And so like a kind of postmodernist kind of expedition into altered states and the nature of reality and the nature of consciousness.
Yeah. I'm sure you've read Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. And it sounds like it did change your mind.
Well, certainly, yeah. It's not always, but certainly a pivotal one-way street, you know. I mean, it's trajected me through my entire career, you know. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't for those formative experiences. So, it was significant, let's say, you know, very significant.
Yeah. So the title of your book is Psychedelics and Extraordinary Human Experiences. What do you mean by our exceptional human experiences? What do you mean by exceptional human experiences?
So it's a term I borrowed from a U.S. researcher actually called Rhea White, who is no longer alive. And she coined this phrase to incorporate a whole range of what we might call transpersonal experiences, you know, those experiences which take you beyond your individual ego identity. So we're going into the realm of, you know, maybe having an experience of cosmic consciousness or an out-of-body experience or an experience of deep empathy or love or connection, something which is profound and takes you beyond your normal sense of ego and makes you kind of question your ordinary state perceived reality.
Yeah. And for you, did that happen as a result of psychedelics, or did it happen prior to that?
Well, I used to have very intense dreams as a young child, and then they kind of wavered for many years, and I've been back into the study of dreams since then on a personal and on a research level. So I think it wasn't just psychedelics, but also dreaming. And I also explore all, you know, as many altered states as I can. So I've done research on meditation and hypnosis, on mediumship, dark rooms, you know, chanting, holotropic breath work. So I explore all of those areas, but my current thrust of research is with psychedelics, and they were probably the most pivotal experiences. Yeah.
Well, we share some of that in common. My doctoral dissertation was on hypnosis and meditation and looking at the role of attention in those two as perhaps the mediating factor. And that was back in 1970 that I finished that. So,
so was that with T.X. Barber by any chance?
Well, certainly I was reading him, and he was, you know, coming from a very skeptical point of view, and so I wasn't crazy about him. He rubbed me wrong in a book, in a way. In your book, you start out by discussing San Pedro cactus, and mm-hmm. I don't think I had heard of San Pedro cactus before my interviews with one Sergei Baranov, who is introducing others to the shamanic path in Peru. Are you familiar with him?
No, I don't know Sergei, no.
Okay, I came, originally he's from Russia, and he's had a very interesting life and path, and now he is in Peru, as I say. And I hadn't heard of San Pedro cactus. So how is it that your book starts off with that?
As much as anything, I mean, the book's quite varied, and I wanted to have it's a collection of essays and also scientific papers, so it's quite a mixed bag. So I wanted to have start off with an essay, which was really just very broad in its scope. You know, anybody could read this and discover something in it. And it's more of a kind of personal journey mixed with some scientific research, where I went to Ecuador with a grant to do some ESP experiments under the influence of San Pedro cactus. What happened was I ran out of time in Ecuador before I could actually run the experiments, before I could find a shaman who'd let me run my experiments in their ceremony. And I had to leave quite soon, so I ended up having to do the experiment on myself instead of kind of getting a sample of 20 people. I ended up doing the experiments myself as the experimenter and the participant. And I did this precognition experiment, which somewhat surprisingly and slightly terrifyingly gave very positive results. So I thought I would start off the book with just a kind of a generic introduction into the kind of things I do as a psychedelic parapsychologist.
Yeah, boy, that's fascinating. You know, certainly I had heard of peyote, which is cactus, and now we have the San Pedro cactus. Are they related?
Very much so, yes. They both contain mescaline in the greatest quantity. That's their kind of their primary alkaloid. So they're both cactuses, of course. They seemingly have maybe 40 or 50 different alkaloids in them as well, some of which they share, but many of which are different. But all of those other alkaloids are trace quantities, but the main constituent being mescaline. So there's quite a lot of parallel, and the experiences are pretty similar, I would say. But there are, you know, there might be subtle differences the well-initiated might be able to discern. In fact, I've got a Mexican peyote shaman in my kitchen at the minute, who's just came over to visit. He'd probably know the difference, although he probably wouldn't take San Pedro because in his tribe that they only take peyote. But so I think most people, the uninitiated, would not perceive the differences, and they are very similar, but I think they're also quite subtly different.
Well, I love that you've got a foot in both worlds, in the world of a trained scientific approach as well as being an intrepid personal explorer at a personal level. And you've dangled a beautiful little hint there about the personal. I would love to hear, if you can share it here, your story of what you described as a positive psychic experience.
Yes, so in the experiment, it's a controlled experiment, and the idea, it follows a kind of basic parapsychological protocol. So under the influence of the mescaline, I would, there's four or five basic stages. There's a visualization, a viewing, a voting, and a verification stage, all beginning with V. And so the visualization stage, I close my eyes and try and visualize a target. And in this case, the target would be a 1 minute video clip. But I didn't know the identity of it. Then I would watch a randomly selected pool of video clips, which had been generated by another researcher. Okay. And they're all heterogeneous, very different video clips, just 1 minute video clips selected from different films. And so I'd see these four 1 minute video clips, one of which would become a target, but I didn't know what the target was. And it hadn't even been selected at this point. So I'd then vote, and I would rank order the video clips by how similar they were to my visualization.
Yes.
And then when I'd done that and it was all documented and I had them kind of ordered into, oh, this one's really like my visualization and this one's nothing like it, I would then run a random number generator and it would select the target. So there's no way you could intuit what the target would be. It's completely independent, somewhat abstract, and the target isn't even selected until the future. So if I'm able to get more of the targets than you'd expect by chance, it's either very improbable or it is accessing information from the future, so i.e. precognition. And so I ran this I did 20 trials of that, which lasted about, it took me about 8 hours to do. In my somewhat mescalinated state. And probabilistically, I got a significant result. But there was a sum of ranks which was significant at the 0.05. And I think I got about 40% of the targets I chose as the number one, where you'd expect 25 by chance. So it isn't a huge difference, but it's enough that statistically, it's significantly different.
Yeah, and that is it's interesting the way that you conducted it just with yourself, but it definitely draws on a tradition of parapsychological research. And I first had my mind opened to, you know, stepping outside of the customary thinking about scientific thinking about parapsychology as a result of Stanley Krippner's early work, and then got to meet him and know him, and I've interviewed him a number of times here on Shrink Wrap Radio. But he was a real pioneer, I think, in parapsychology. And thanks for sharing that. That gives us both a good taste of the scientific side and the personal side. So feel free as we go along to just throw from both sides.
I like to think it's important to have both a first person and a third person objective, you know, insight into this research. I think, you probably wouldn't trust a sexologist who was a virgin, you know, or a musicologist who was deaf, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think there's something to be gained. And certainly you probably wouldn't be wanting be administering psychedelics in a research project unless you knew what the experience was for yourself. I think this whole idea of, oh, well, you're going to diminish your objectivity if you've taken the substances yourself. I think that's a kind of rather archaic idea. I think on the contrary, it gives you some real insights about, what the experience is like, what methodology is going to be appropriate, the kind of things you can and can't put your subjects through, your participants through, you know. So I'm a great advocate for scientists also having a first-hand perspective on these old states that they're researching. And it is very, I think it's very worthwhile and valuable in advancing the research.
I totally agree. And I've sometimes reflected on, I think for a long time, people in the world of yoga, if you will, talked about the science of yoga. And at first that seemed like to the young graduate student, that seems like kind of, well, that's not what we call science. That's not what we learned in graduate school. Science is. But I've come to realize that that kind of internal research going into the internal world with an open attitude to see what can be learned there, and what kinds of skills can be developed, a person can be a scientist in that way. It's a different kind of science, but I won't go on about that, but I'm on the same page with you there. Talk to us a bit about ayahuasca. I mean, that's one of the substances for which there seems to be just a huge explosion, with ayahuasca ceremonies happening everywhere from New York City to Los Angeles to London and Scandinavia and beyond.
Yeah, very much
so.
And
it sounds scary. I've not taken ayahuasca, and I'm a little scared of it.
Well, it's certainly not recreational, I would say, you know. I wouldn't imagine people taking it at a party particularly, you know. It's not that kind of psychedelic. It's quite heavy duty, and so consequently, I think it has potentially huge benefits. And I think this rise of the use of ayahuasca has come in synchrony with this psychedelic research renaissance. So on the one hand, you have this kind of explosion in academic and clinical research of psychedelics. And on the other hand, synchronously, you have this rise of interest in you know, medicine circles, if you like. You know, people taking part in neo-shamanic or shamanic healing paradigms of using psychedelics, and ayahuasca has probably received the most attention. There really has been an explosion of interest in it. You know, it's you can go on TripAdvisor now and, you know, put up ayahuasca retreat Iquitos, and it'll come up with a list of 30 or 40 ayahuasca retreats, you know, in the vicinity of the city.
Wow. I haven't done that. I heard that.
It's a real TripAdvisor, you know?
The real TripAdvisor. Yeah. That's funny.
So there is a huge wave of ayahuasca tourism. And from a clinical perspective, there's not been many full-blown clinical trials done with it, but there's been a lot of preliminary research looking at the potential medicinal benefits of them. And, you know, we're finding it has great potential efficacy in treating everything from anxiety and depression, possibly things like diabetes and even cancer, and maybe even neurodegenerative diseases. So there's a lot to explore in the potential benefits of these substances as medicaments, let alone the kind of personal and spiritual or creative problem-solving insights that people may gain from the experience as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that you note that it's not a recreational substance. And so what's interesting about that is that so many people are drawn to it. It's not fun.
No.
And yet people are drawn to it in larger and larger numbers. So to me, that speaks to something about the hunger as human beings, particularly in this society at this point in time, for some experience of transcendence and growth, even if it does entail risk and pain.
Absolutely. And I think that's probably driven by a couple of things which may be interrelated. And that is, in this increasingly secular society, you know, everything has become devoid of meaning in a way. And you know, people need meaning to get up and have a purpose in life, you know, every day. And so I think people are rejecting traditional religious orthodoxy, but still feeling a whole and seeking kind of a more individualistic personal spirituality. And simultaneously, you know, urban diseases like depression and anxiety are constantly on the increase. So, you know, clinical depression runs at about 25% in London, you know, most of the work, a quarter of the workforce are depressed. And so people, and they're disenamored with the treatment. You know, psychiatry is somewhat in crisis, unlike the medical professions, which have progressed in their technologies and treatments. You know, my psychiatric colleagues still say the most effective thing for treating depression is ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, like bzzzt, which is somewhat barbaric, has terrible consequences for some people and the side effects of amnesia, and is still not really understood how it works. So I think people are looking for alternative spiritual inspiration and also assistance with dealing with their psychological conditions.
Definitely, definitely. Something that you write about is psychedelic possession, and that's a different kind of idea for me. Are you referring to something like spirit possession, or is it something else?
Yeah, spirit possession. So this was a curious article I wrote, which came out of some visits to Brazil, and they have Christian churches in Brazil, which are kind of these syncretic mixes where they've taken indigenous ayahuasca use and mixed it with kind of Western esotericism and Christianity. This is like this kind of Brazilian eclectic churches, like the Santa Daime. So it's a Christian church ostensibly, and they have hymns and they have mass, but they have ayahuasca as the sacrament during the mass, and everyone drinks ayahuasca, and you know, it's quite different. Wasn't like that when I went to church, you know.
No. And,
one of the things that's, because it's so eclectic, Brazil, kind of spiritually speaking, with all these different cultural influences, they've also started adopting Afro-Brazilian transpossession influences as well. So now there's a group called Umbanda, with Afro-Brazilian transpossession, which started about the same time as Santa Daime Church, and now these two things are in some regions are beginning to get fused together. So they have people drinking ayahuasca in a Christian church setting and going into like transpossession states, which I thought was astonishing. And it occurred to me, I've never really heard of people mixing transpossession with psychedelics, even in all the shamanic traditions. And so I did some research into that. And in fact, I could barely find a single example outside of this Umbandami where possession is mixed with psychedelic shamanism. So it's a rare kind of confluence of different traditions. And we don't really see that. This is something new that's come out of this kind of super eclectic, you know, ultra urbanized Brazilian way of just throwing all these different traditions together.
Yeah, fascinating. Actually, I did grow up with the idea of possession because my grandparents were evangelists, and they believed in becoming possessed by the Holy Spirit. And then healings could occur and so on. I never really bought into the whole thing, but I certainly observed it. And there was the idea that equally that one was vulnerable perhaps to becoming possessed by an evil spirit. So the idea of possession has been out there for a long time in a lot of different ways. But you're right, I haven't heard of that paired with using a substance other than little sips of wine.
it's a very novel thing.
Yeah. And speaking of novel things, I think one of the newer drugs for us to become aware of in the West is Iboga and Ibogaine. Tell us a bit about those.
So most of the psychedelics we know of, particularly the ones which are in current favor, the traditional plant ones at least, come from, you know, the new world, the Americas, and then there's the new synthetic ones like semi-synthetic, like LSD and MDMA and ketamine. And there's very few psychedelics that we know of from Africa, and Iboga is probably the one that we know the most about. It's similar in many respects to traditional other psychedelics. the experience is typically more prolonged. It's been used traditionally by the Bwiti cult, and before them by the Mbongo tribe, I think. If I get that right, they're pygmies from the Congo. So it has like a kind of long history of use, but it's only recently been kind of discovered by in the West. And one of the astonishing things about iboga, beyond other psychedelics, is it seems to have some unique pharmacological properties and advantages in treating heroin addiction. So whereas psychedelics have been shown to be very, very useful and efficacious in treating addictions to other drugs, you know, like heroin and cocaine and alcohol and so on, iboga seems to excel in that regard as well, because it has this effect of resetting people's tolerances, and therefore they don't have any cravings. So people can go through the iboga experience, which may last, you know, 36 hours. I mean, it's wow. not a short ride, and come out to the other side with no physiological cravings to heroin. And so it has quite a high success rate for treating heroin addiction. It's also a bit more toxic than most of the other psychedelics, and there are various contraindications. So it has some contraindications for people with heart conditions, and it can also affect the liver. And occasionally, very occasionally, people do die from taking iboga. Whereas, you know, LSD and psilocybin, for instance, that you can't overdose on an LSD or psilocybin. They're physiologically very safe. Iboga is a bit more different. And also one of the other concerns is that people, because they have reset their tolerance to heroin, if they do relapse in a short period of time after they've come off heroin, they can overdose quite easily on heroin. And so most of the people who die as a result of taking iboga die as a result of actually going back to their prior dose of heroin, which is that they have no tolerance for, and it they can overdose on the heroin. But it's a very interesting substance in that it gives you a, you know, 36-hour experience. In their initiation ceremonies, they keep giving it to people, they feed them with it, and they keep them in this state of deep trance. They test that by putting pins in the back of their neck to see if they respond, to see how dissociated they are, and they'll keep people maybe in that state for 3 or 4 days in the Bwiti cult initiations. I've tried it once, and my experience was quite similar to a lot of experiences that people report, is that you have a life review like experience. Starting from my first memories, I spent the next 36 hours going through the first 10 years of my life. Not remembering it, but like first person reliving it, which is extraordinary. And then you would kind of move through it at a, you know, a steady pace. And then occasionally you'd get caught up in these like incidents, you know, not necessarily traumas, but just like incidents in my life. I'd get stuck in a loop where I'd replay and replay and replay and replay until I found some kind of mental way out of it, some kind of resolution, or, you know, had got the point of that incident, you know, and then carry on. It was quite exhausting, but extremely interesting experience, you know.
Yeah, wow, I've not heard a first-person report like that before. Sounds almost like some kind of a anxiety loop, such as I sometimes experience in the dream world.
Yeah,
you just kind of keep going through.
It could be like that, you know, like recurring dreams, you know, it's a bit like that kind of thing. But I managed to get as far as age 10. I don't know if we're going to go back and replay the other few decades in any hurry, but maybe one day.
Well, boy, I'm just impressed with how ripe we are with for good, solid research. That there's so much that's coming forward that needs to be researched, and yet it's been held back by governmental regulations and fear.
Yeah, certainly. I think it's getting easier, though. I mean, in the UK, we're seeing quite an expansion of research. The biggest issue now, I mean, you can do this research, you know. I've been involved in various projects, and they're administering psilocybin and LSD and DMT and MDMA. So it is possible, but it's prohibited primarily by funding and also the category of the drugs themselves. Because of prohibition, it means they're in their own category of licensing, which means you have to have a home office license, and they need to be secure, and they need to be kept in a very secure way. And also it makes the cost of the actual drugs very expensive for research. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's no longer impossible to do this research as it was in the 70s, 80s and 90s. But it is still prohibitively expensive. And added to that, you know, the governments haven't as yet been putting up much funding for this kind of research. It's mostly come from philanthropy or crowdfunding, and also the pharmaceutical industries haven't been interested in funding this research either. So it's been a kind of a labor of love primarily for researchers, and it's been paid for by people who've taken psychedelics and experienced the benefit of it, you know, which kind of speaks volumes.
Fascinating. Do you think that the pendulum will keep swinging in this direction? Or is it going to correct and come back and smash it all up?
No, I think it's, I mean, in this third wave, I think the differences between this and the second wave is that it's been done, we've learned from the mistakes of the 60s, I think. We know a lot more about these substances. We're better educated about them. We're a bit more sober in our approach, you know, collectively as researchers. It's good science. There's a lot that can be learned. And also, there isn't the media hysteria that there was in the 60s. You know, the media played a large role in you know, kind of demonizing these substances. Yeah. And we don't see that currently. You know, people are really interested in the science. Some of the LSD papers they published at Imperial College here in London last year was one of the top 10 most read science news of the year, you know. It's like It's big and positive science news. You know, it's like scientists are really interested in these substances for what we can learn about the brain and the mind and consciousness. Physicians and clinicians and psychiatrists are interested about their potential benefits for clinical conditions. I think people want to see them cautiously, you know, deregulated so that they can be used in treatment and probably recreationally.
Yeah. Let's talk about DMT. I know you've written a whole book about DMT and also, I don't know if it was from you or someone else, who's referred to it as the God molecule. What's going on there?
Yeah, that was Rick Strassman, who was actually the kind of the one who spearheaded this psychedelic renaissance in the 1990s, because he kind of cleverly looked at DMT, which nobody knew what it was, right? So it didn't have the same hysteria attached to it, because it was a very underground, unknown psychedelic. So in the 90s, he applied, and it took him a couple of years eventually to convince the authorities and the ethics bodies and, you know, the regulatory bodies to do research on DMT. And he in his book, he called it the spirit molecule. So DMT is probably, in a way, one of the most fascinating of the psychedelics, primarily because, well, it's one of the most potent, in a way, subjectively. You know, if you smoke it or have it injected in the lab, say, it'll give you it starts working almost immediately, and it lasts about 10 minutes, but it'd probably be the most intense 10 minutes of your life. You know, it's extremely subjectively potent, and this is probably also why it's naturally occurring in the human body. It's naturally occurring across a wide swathe of nature. We find it in many, many plants. We find it in all mammals. It's found in lizards and in birds. Interestingly, it's not found in insects or fungus, but fungus have their own version, which is called psilocybin and psilocin. magic mushrooms, which is 4-hydroxy-DMT. So it's a very similar cousin, but a fungal version. So DMT is, you know, we make it in our own bodies, which has various implications. And Rick's theory was that spontaneous mystical experiences or, you know, near-death experiences could be explained by a burst of DMT from your own body. We are our own psychedelic chemical factories, you know. We're producing these substances, perhaps in very small quantities, but we are making these substances, you know. And that has huge implications and throws up a whole wealth of questions about the nature of DMT, especially when the experiences are so astonishing, you know. Actually, there's some data they got from John Hopkins, which they haven't published yet. They did a big survey about DMT experiences, and they found that it was able to convert a number of atheists, you know, quite a large proportion of their sample were no longer atheists after their DMT experience.
Is that why it got called the God molecule?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it has the power to completely reset people's worldview in the space of 10 minutes. You know, that's not nothing, really.
Yeah, boy.
It is an astonishing substance, there has been very little research done on it with humans, so there's so much we don't know, which, you know, is right for
research. Is it now on the schedules as a dangerous thing?
Currently it's a Class A drug in the UK and Schedule 1 in the States. You know, it's in the highest category of dangerous drugs, which is ironic because we have it in our own bodies, you know. So, you know, technically we're producing DMT all the time, so we're constantly illegal, you know. Which makes a bit of a mockery of the legal system, you know. It's like we're constantly producing illegal drugs. It doesn't make much sense, really.
So what's the story on psilocybin and psychic experiences? Do you think that there is some kind of a connection there, that psilocybin is kind of optimized for maybe a parapsychological experience?
I think all the psychedelics have the potential to induce psychic experiences of one variety or another. The first thing I did when I started this research was do a survey asking people the different drugs they'd taken and whether or not they'd had any transpersonal or paranormal or exceptional experiences under the influence of these drugs. And of course, the psychedelic drugs were the ones that people had these transpersonal exceptional experiences with. And if you compare them, say for instance, on average, my sample, 50% of people had taken psychedelics, like half the sample, had an experience of telepathy whilst under the influence of a psychedelic. Whereas if you look at non-psychedelic drugs, if you compare it to like alcohol or cocaine or tobacco or coffee, you know, you get like about 1 or 2% of people will go, oh yeah, I had an experience of telepathy under the influence of cocaine or alcohol, you know. So there's something about these drugs which induce the experience at the very least. Now, whether or not that's a genuine experience requires more research because there's been very few extant controlled experiments to look at this under, you know, controlled conditions to see if people are either, you know, are they either just deluded and think they're having a telepathic experience, or can we demonstrate this in a controlled laboratory setting? And there's been about a dozen experiments which were done mostly in the 60s. And some of those were not so good, and some of them were quite positive. Unfortunately, most of them were quite badly controlled, so we can't really say much really about them under today's kind of current scientific standards. So I've been redoing these experiments in better controlled conditions and had some pretty positive results so far. So I think just as a proof of process, I think there's more to explore, and I think it's worthwhile really putting these things under the microscope to see if they do genuinely produce or enhance the capacity for having psychic, genuine psychic experience.
Yeah.
But, you know, certainly people report a lot more of these experiences under these substances. Actually, and psilocybin, when psilocybin mushrooms were first discovered as being psychoactive, which was the Gordon Wasson, R. Gordon Wasson and his wife Valentina, they went down to Mexico. They found this mushroom shaman, and he did a ceremony for them where he took the mushrooms. He didn't give them any. And, you know, they had to take like a 5-day donkey ride up into the mountains to find this guy. And he told them all these things about their son back home in the States that they didn't even know, right? And when they got home, they found out he was right. So, you know, it's like, how does this guy in the middle of nowhere up a mountain, 5 days donkey ride, know all these things about their son back home in the States that they didn't even know, you know? He was under the influence of the mushroom. So
that reminds me of Ram Dass's story when he went to India and he met his guru, and his guru kind of blew his mind in a similar fashion.
Yes, yes, indeed.
So science really has some work to do, cut out for it, to really establish the even just the existence of these, and to validate it, and then to better understand the processes by which this kind of thing can happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, another thing that you talk about that I found interesting was what you call cross-species or psychedelic sense, species consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what are you referring to there? I have a story I want to tell you, but I want to see what you've got to say.
Yeah, so in the course of my research, I mean, one thing that pops up is people seem to have a greater connection to nature. You know, a lot of times people have experiences of you know, having a first-person perspective of some other species. You know, certainly the experience of it, whether or not genuinely. And people, you know, seemingly become more connected to nature. And I looked through the literature, and there wasn't any data on this whatsoever. You know, there was no evidence to back this up, other than lots of anecdotes. So I did a survey, and there's been a couple of others published since I did mine as well, where I looked, asked people, you know, has taking psychedelics increased your connection to nature, your concern for nature, and what kind of experiences have you had? And also, has it changed not just your attitude, but your behavior? And I found that 100% of people who had taken psychedelics said they had greater connection to nature as a result of taking psychedelics. The majority of them were also more concerned about nature as a result. Some were less concerned, interestingly, in their attitudes. However, in terms of behavioral changes, you know, more than half the population said they had taken up more ecological activism. Half the population said they'd changed their diet, you know, become more organic or vegan or local or vegetarian. And half the population said they'd increased gardening, you know, as a result of that psychedelic. This is like headline news, you know. Yeah. Dangerous psychedelic drugs make people do more gardening. and even people change their careers. So 16% of my sample said they changed their career to something more ecologically orientated. Wow. As a result of their psychedelic. To give an example, two people quit their previous careers to take up PhDs in botany because they'd had a psychedelic experience. So you have a great potential for changing people's ecological consciousness. And also, I looked at their transpersonal nature-related experiences, you know, and I don't know, like a quarter of people had taken like ayahuasca and things like that felt like they'd had an experience of becoming another species, of, you know, having a first-person experience. Or more than 50% taken ayahuasca felt like they had communicated with the spirit or the intelligence of ayahuasca itself, you know, they communicated with the plant itself. And these kinds of experiences, which I think are probably important in making people more ecologically orientated.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating.
They might just be the best chance for saving the planet. Who knows?
Yeah, the anecdote that I wanted to add to your pile of anecdotal evidence is I assume what I had taken was LSD. Of course, in the 60s, we never knew for sure what we were taking, or at least and not unless you were connected to the mainstream of the people who could make it. So I was on an LSD trip, if you will, and it was nighttime, and I went out into Ann Arbor, where I was in graduate school at the time, and a dog started following me. And it was a delightful dog. I just felt such a connection with that dog. And the dog stayed with me all night. No matter where I walked or what I did, here was this dog as if he was my dog. And as the sun was coming up the following morning, and I was still out there, and I'm walking down the street, kind of coming down from this experience, and somebody that I don't know comes another student comes up and says, "Oh, you must be tripping." And of course, I got very paranoid. Oh no, does it show? And you know, I said, he said, don't freak out. He says, but this dog that's following you, he loves to follow people that are tripping. He just digs being around them.
That's amazing.
Wow. Yeah, that was amazing. And the other thing that comes to mind is I think it's possible to also connect with maybe with children in a deeper way, to be more attentive, to be more at their level.
Yeah.
And you're the father of a 2-year-old, I believe.
That's right, I am, yeah.
Yeah, what's that like? And how are these two sets of passions articulating?
Well, I don't really have much time for personal exploration these days, being a father of a 2-year-old, and I haven't done any research in that area yet, but I think it's very worthwhile exploring. I think that I feel some more research coming on in that department. I think it's, I mean, Michael Pollan in his book does talk about it, how, you know, Robin Carr Harris had done all this brain imaging research, and it comes to the conclusion that it takes you back to a more childlike mental state, you know, in terms of the kind of novelty status of activity in the brain. And so there is some sense that neurobiologically and subjectively, you know, you find you're in a child, and actually psychologically you're in a more childlike state. So it makes sense that you would be able to have a deeper connection with children as well.
Yeah. You know, going back to that same period of time, on my very first LSD trip, I had a tremendous sense of recognition of, oh, I know this place. And it felt like I was in child consciousness, if you will. And that's why it seemed familiar. I had been there before. And of course, that was before the kind of some of the research and speculation that's current now. So I think we've done it, you know. I think we've covered a lot of ground here, and I really have to congratulate you on condensing all your rich experience in writing and research and so on into a palatable hour-long pellet.
Well, I should be congratulating you for asking such brilliant questions. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you, David.
Thank you. I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much.
I felt quite joyful speaking with David Luke. If I'm honest, I'd have to confess the reason is I feel like I'm looking at a good version of myself in some alternate universe. In other words, it's great to connect with someone I agree with so much. Of course, we only just met, and I don't really know him that well, but he fits my projection of someone I might have become. Back when I was in graduate school, I didn't imagine that it would ever be possible to have the sort of academic career he's enjoying, namely working at a mainstream university and openly conducting research focused on psychedelics, consciousness, and parapsychology, as well as writing about personal explorations with a variety of psychedelic substances and traveling the world to study with shamans and so on. I came up in a time when those all would have been more or less fireable offenses. So I marvel at how the world has changed in a relatively short period of time. It gives me a bit more optimism for the future. If that much of a change can happen over a period of 40 years or so, think of how much more they can change in the next 40. Of course, the dark forces of repression are ever lurking, so we'll have to wait and see. I may be painting too ideal a picture of David's academic career. It may be he's one of the still rare and early pioneers who perhaps has had to buck a fair amount of criticism and opposition to be where he is. Maybe he's the tip of what will become increasingly common in academic psychology departments. You heard me confess to being fearful of taking ayahuasca myself. While I'm intrigued and excited to see what's unfolding in this third wave psychedelic movement, I'm not likely to participate personally. To some extent, I've been there and done that. When I was younger, for better or for worse, I was willing to roll the dice. Now that my identity and place in the world is relatively fixed and I have a large family dependent on me, I can't see that it makes sense for me to throw everything up in the air hoping it will somehow reassemble, either as it was or into something better. One thing that has occurred to me after this interview and others is that it makes sense that this generation of psychedelic explorers are drawing on ancient wisdom to conduct these psychedelic voyages in ceremonial circles, using the power of community and the leadership of those who have been there to set expectations and provide a safe container. Finally, let me say that if you're interested in such topics as psychedelics, consciousness, and our parapsychology, you'll certainly want to have this book in your library. The title, once again, is Other Worlds, Psychedelics and Exceptional Human Experience by David Luke, Ph.D.
Support Shrink Wrap Radio for Dr. Dave has his pulse on the emerging contemporary rising stars, endeavoring to provide soul food for listeners seeking nourishment. As a recent contributor, I am listening deeply to the contributions you bring us all.
Thank you, Linda Thompson. I so appreciate your support and that of so many others. Beyond financial support, another way of supporting Shrink Wrap Radio is the volunteer labor of creating transcripts of these interviews. I'm happy to report that we have a new transcript on the site. It's episode number 46, The Narcissistic Personality with Maria Hess, Ph.D., and that's thanks to Kat Bautista. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. David Luke, for sharing his pioneering work in psychedelics and exceptional human experience. Next week, I'll be speaking once again with Brett Carr, UK professor and psychoanalyst, about his latest book on how to flourish as a psychotherapist. Having interviewed him twice before, and with him showing up on our best of list, I can promise you a wonderful interview. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.